You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel.
Yes, indeed. And with all the style and sincerity of a Pepsi Cola commercial, we bring you episode 301, in which we try to generate enthusiasm for Record Store Day. We explore what football managers have in common with Jeremy Corbyn and Donald Trump. And Juliet's been to see the Jesus and Mary chain. Were they any good? That's all coming up after Gossip and Careless Whisper.
Time can never mend the careless whisper of a good friend. To your heart and mind, ignorance is kind. There's no comfort in the truth. Pain is all you find.
From a covers album that was released a few years ago now, 2007. It was called Radio 1 Established 1967, and it was to celebrate 40 years of Radio 1. And pretty much roughly each year is represented. A different artist was given a year and told that they had to cover a song from that year. I feel it's a bit sorry for the Kaiser Chiefs that were given 1967, so had to do Flowers in the Rain by The Move. But that was the Gossip were given 1984, so they did Careless Whisper, and I think that's a great version.
I'd never heard of this album until you picked this track this week, and then I went to Wikipedia to look at its provenance and saw all these cover versions. I can't wait to listen to it now. Because, as you say, it seems to be an artist. Yeah, every year from 1967 onwards for 40 years, and a different artist covering a song from each of the respective years. And some of them look quite inspired, and I really am going to seek that out and play that later on. It looks really good fun.
And interesting. interestingly, my favourites on this album, apart from that, which I think is great, Kylie Minogue doing Love Is the Drug is really good. Really? And so Franz Ferdinand do Sound and Vision by David Bowie. Yeah. Girls Aloud do backing vocals on that. And the reason they do is because it is produced by Xenomania, who were the kind of production team that were famous for doing Girls Aloud. They were almost like the Stock Aitken Waterman of that sort of era. And interestingly, Franz Ferdinand had the idea they would try and do an album with them, but I think they only did a few songs and then they decided that it wasn't going to work across a whole album. But I would recommend that. That's excellent.
Yes, I'm really going to listen to that later. Welcome to a podcast from the Parish Council, brought to you by the Media Motel. It's episode 301. I'm Terence Stackham, and don't whisper it, shout it to the heavens, it's Juliet Harris.
Hello.
it's that time of year again, Jules. When we celebrate, it's that time of year when we celebrate renewal from the dead.
Absolutely, that is very much these vibes.
Yes, indeed, it's Record Store Day in a couple of weeks, a special day in the calendar now where people who for about 30 years no longer bothered with vinyl now find their lives are meaningless unless they queue up for a live LP from the Grateful Dead or a Hawkwind single from 1976 in a new picture sleeve on blue transparent vinyl. I'm not kidding, both of those fine products are major attractions this year. This Record Store Day business, Jules, it's about as convincing as the new Pepsi Cola commercial.
Oh, I love how you refuse. Not only do you refuse to get on board with the vinyl revival, you are basically my dad. You just literally hit me with it every single week and take great pleasure in trashing something that I might potentially enjoy. So, as ever, it's a pleasure and a privilege to do this podcast and have this time with you. So I quite enjoy Record Store Day. Okay. I don't always do it. This year, I'll probably be spending it in Music's Not Dead in Bexhill because they do a sort of day of it where they get lots of live acts, and I went last year and really enjoyed it. Actually, they had lots of cool people. They've got someone from the Weather Prophets this year, which I'm really looking forward to. Being an indie revivalist, I might take my single to have it signed, but which I did not buy on Record Store Day. I bought it in a second hand shop. But so the sort of light and Union Music in Lewiston similar, and so I like the idea that you're sort of celebrating music, and they don't charge, so you can watch all these acts for free in their shop, which is you don't have to buy anything, which is a good thing. Which is a really good thing. And it was at Record Store Day last year that I realised that the PJ Harvey album that had just been released was probably going to get to number one, because I saw 9 out of 12 people in the queue with it under their arms, and I thought, I think something might be happening here. New records are extremely expensive. I mean, it has to be said, they are very dear. I feel sorry for my friends at Wow and Flutter, who of course are second hand, and they always take the attitude, well, every day is Record Store Day in here, which I quite enjoy. Like you say, there is a rip off element to it which is unattractive now. I mean, there was more point to it, I suppose, when it first started. I'm trying to look up when it first started. It's been going for a few years, but it's kind of been gathering an impetus every year, and it's difficult. It's almost like a chicken and an egg syndrome. Was that responsible for reviving vinyl? Or has the vinyl revival made Record Store Day more of a do than it was at first? Because at first it was quite minor, really. I mean, not everywhere kind of did it. I'm trying to look at... I can't find when it first started. I think it's
about
probably...
About 10 years, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. I mean, the problem with it now, of course, is that it's gone beyond... I like the aspect of it, the way you can buy independent things that you couldn't otherwise buy. And they did do a series of mystery cover singles with no details at all on them. And you just buy them, and they release a list of the ones that were on these singles, so you'd know what you potentially could be getting, but you didn't know what you were getting. And I think that's actually quite a fun, novel thing to do. But now, as you say, things seem to be moving towards the reissue market. I spoke to my friends in Music Not Dead about this the other day. It's run by two lovely chaps called Rich and Dell, and they said, oh, well, we're trying to work the order out. And I didn't realise. So the list is released of everything that's being released for Record Store Day, all of the exclusives for Record Store Day. So they have to sit and go through the list, work out what they think is going to sell in their shop, put their order in, and then there is no guarantee that they will actually get their order that they want, because of course every shop in Britain slash America slash the world is trying to do the same thing, and there is of course a limited amount of stock. I mean, often Jack White releases stuff from his Third Man record label, and you know, their press is not massive, and so they only have a limited amount of stock. I was talking to them about David Bowie stuff, speaking of releases, and they said that usually David Bowie's a dead cert. Last year there were something like a dozen reissues or something, presumably, you know, off the back of his death as well. And they said that they ordered them all and that they all went, and that you can guarantee that you're going to be able to sell David Bowie stuff. This year there are only two reissues, and one of them is madly expensive. It's some big reissue thing, and it's about £60, I think. And so they've gone from thinking, oh, we'll definitely order David Bowie stuff, to not being sure that it's going to sell. And the thing that's particularly ticked me off this year about reissues, regular listeners to both this and my radio will know that I'm a huge fan of Elastica. So I have not one but two copies. When they released their debut album called Elastica on vinyl, which is now seen as a bit of a kind of a cult classic, they did an initial run that had a free kind of paper magazine that was called Elastica Catalog, that was like a bit of a fanzine that was about 8 or 12 pages long, and which was, you know, not brilliant, you know, not special, but a nice thing, and a flexi disc. Which had Cleopatra, but them covering Cleopatra by Adam and the Ants, and it was numbered and, you know, quote unquote limited edition. So I bought one of these, lost the flexi disc when I moved house once, so then promptly bought another one off the internet. I guess they might be reissuing it earlier on this year. They are reissuing the debut album on vinyl, having previously had it reissued on red vinyl for a previous record store day. They're re-releasing the first album. I thought, okay, fair enough. But, and here's the twist, there's going to be a flexi disc with a different song on it.
Oh, Lord,
which
see,
means
this is
that
a thing.
Now I'm probably going to go out and buy that, because I am a completist, and I am the kind of, you know, foolish person with money who this is aimed at. So actually, previously I was quite a defender of record store day, and there are aspects of it, I think, if you go to particular stores that do a good job of it, then it is quite a good fun thing to celebrate. And I still am glad that vinyl is coming back, because it's just something that I really enjoy. But having said that, the Elastica reissue scandal, it's not a scandal, but it is to me, has made me perhaps, and I hate to say this, Terence, come round to your way of thinking.
Well,
that it is rip-off day, really.
Yes. 2007, by the way, so people don't need to tweet it and tell us. Okay. 2007 was the first one. No, I mean, I don't want to rain on anyone's parade, genuinely, and if this special day means owners of independent stores make some money, then that's okay. But, you know, a couple of things. I mean, are the people queuing up at 4 a.m. for those David Bowie special
packs?
I mean,
I don't do that, can I just point out?
No.
I wander in at 10 o'clock and see whatever's left. My friend Neil does queue up early, and I do have friends that do say, I'm in the queue, what do you want? So in a way, it's quite nice that everyone all fellow record nerds experience solidarity together.
But whether you turn up at 4 a.m. or 11 a.m, I wonder whether many of those customers are going to be returning regularly, you know, to buy in these stores. My instinct says not. And of course, as ever in life, a possibly noble idea has been hijacked by big business. That element that you mentioned there, where the major labels insisting that shops buy on buy on a non return basis, by the way, but you know, almost like a tombola kind of affair, which could leave some shops obviously left with a pig in a poke that they can't get rid of.
I think the music's not dead have a sort of a kind of a remainder bin. I think there's stuff in there from record store day about 3 years ago.
Well, there you are. And I think it's also very telling that some artists are now saying that they won't participate in record store day. Paul Weller is in that camp.
Interesting.
This is because you know, he said that there's many examples of people standing in line for some limited edition release, and then they head straight home, stick it up on eBay for $1,000, and you know, the real fan then thinks, oh, I'm a completist, rather like you referring to Elastica, and thinks, oh, you know, I must have this Paul Weller 12-inch single, okay, I'm going to pay $1,000 for it.
And I think that's what scotched it in the early days. Certainly when it first started, that used to happen a lot, and I got to a stage where I just thought, oh, I'm not going to bother with this, because, you know, I don't want to pay 300 quid for it online. And I think that actually major labels releasing stuff might have been a response to that, really, because it did. I did certainly feel that it went from being very niche slash flog this on eBay to being rather less niche. And in a way, that's why I think that might have been why some of the smaller record stores decided then to put bands on and things as a sort of way of keeping people interested in Record Store Day, even if, for example, you can't be asked to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to get a Future Heads flexi disc or whatever. Actually, my best ever Record Store Day experience, apart from going to see bands, was the year that I woke up at 8:30 in the morning, noticed that Savages, a band that I'd been to see before then, this would have been 2013, I think, who I liked very, very much, they posted online, oh, for special Record Store Day, we're going to sell a limited edition, I really don't think they did very many, clear vinyl of our album, and all four of us have signed the sleeve, and it's £15, which was no more than it would be anyway, actually, and we've put a few up on our, they had a sort of a label of pop noir or something like that, we put a few up on our site, and when they're gone, but enjoy. Didn't have to go and queue up, wasn't charged an enormous amount of money for something which actually was quite special, and so I put my £15 in, paid via PayPal, got one, it turned up a few days later, I've still got it in my house, and the sleeve is genuinely signed by them in silver pen, and I didn't have to leave bed throughout, and they didn't try to make any money off it, they just did it to celebrate Record Store Day, but they didn't charge an extra amount of money, and I think bands doing Record Store Day could probably learn a lot from Savages. I think
you're a genuine fan and a genuine music fan, of course. I mean, we all know that, but I think it also tends to appeal to people who see records as a kind of fashion accessory.
They'll Hipsters,
come,
yeah,
they'll
absolutely.
Come home with their limited edition thing, and then go up, go online and buy a frame to put it in and put it on there. Sort of...
And it's never opened and never played. Yeah, exactly. Whereas my Savages record probably isn't worth as much as it could be because I've played it.
Yeah,
I mean the sleeve is still signed, but you know I have played my record. So, but then having said that, I buy records to play them. And I mean, Urban, I think I've talked about this a bit previously on the podcast, but as we don't expect everybody to listen to every podcast,
I don't know about that.
Well, it would be nice if you did, but equally, you know, I as someone that is a frequent dipper in life, if you've yet to have the time, Terence, is that better? If you've yet to have the time to listen to a previous podcast where we talked about vinyl revival. Because this is a topic which you often return to bash me on, and I often have to defend.
Yes.
I still cannot believe Urban Outfitters, speaking of, are sort of a clothing chain, who I rather like, actually, but they are inclined towards the hipster end of the spectrum, shall we say. They've got a sale on giant pool inflatables at the moment. I am half tempted to buy a 3-foot-high inflatable cactus for my lounge, but I think I might resist. It did look good, though. But they sell vinyl and tapes as well, because we are oddly experiencing a tape revival as well, as we spoke about the other week. And they sell records, but they are selling reissued records. I still can't get over the fact that they're selling a reissued version of Spice by the Spice Girls for £30 on vinyl.
Lord.
I will never, ever be over that. So, yes, they are cashing in on 90s sort of, well, millennials. This is you know, people that would have remembered that the first time round, but would have been young enough to have liked it rather than to have been slightly sneery about it. So yeah, I do see what you mean. It is exploiting kind of hipster types as well. I mean, in a way, Record Store Day is perfect if you're kind of, you know, someone that wants to make a lot of money, because you can appeal to young hipster types and hard-bitten, largely male recordy nerd types, and also people like me that are somewhere in the middle. But yeah, so, I mean, I don't have quite the antipathy towards it as you do, but I can see that it is a bit of a, it's turned into rapidly into a bit of a commercial circus, really, which is a shame.
22nd of April, if you are interested in when Record Store Day is this year.
And if you want to be here, you can come to Music Not Dead on that day, but don't really have to.
Never apologise, never explain is a mantra that's clung to by people, usually in public life, who see saying sorry as a form of weakness.
Seems to be the hardest word, Terence, doesn't
sorry
it?
Sorry seems to be the hardest word. We'll be looking at when it's right to say you're wrong, right after the new single from the excellent Martin Carr. partly inspired by that photo of Trump and Farage grinning at Trump Tower in New York.
Yeah, sticking it to the man, the anti-establishment dude.
Absolutely. The splendid new single by Martin Carr. It's available for £2 through his Bandcamp page, which is Sunny Boy. Martin Carr and Gold Lift. When the Sunderland manager, now it's obligatory to refer to him as the beleaguered Sunderland manager.
And we said that we've just, on Podcast Passim, he is the unlucky elf of football, isn't he?
He really is, unlucky elf. David Moyes made some dismal, appalling remarks to the BBC reporter Vicky Sparks. When he did this, he probably felt that his anxiety to move on, as he put it, was not helped by the comedian Jim Davidson leaping to his defence.
Yes, if Jim Davidson is defending you, I'm not sure it's going that well, by and large.
No. That is a good rule for life. And Davison said that Moyes shouldn't apologise. But in some ways, what is most significant, I think, to me about Moyes' reactions to his own shortcomings, he says about the reaction, he says, I've been surprised in many ways, referring to the level of criticism he has received for telling a woman she might, quote, get a slap even though you're a woman, and also a quote, careful the next time you come in.
Oh,
Jules, is it better if you never apologise, never explain?
No, I don't think it is, really. And actually, again, this is, and I think this is increasingly, I think we'll talk about this in a sport context, but this is increasingly starting to colour public life.
Public life, politics as well, yeah.
Absolutely. And I say that because the theme of this week's podcast seemed to be that we've talked about things on previous podcasts, but I think we talked about Naz Shah, I think, ages ago.
Oh, gosh, a long time ago.
Who was the Labour MP, the young Labour MP, well, I say young, recently elected Labour MP,
Bradford. Wasn't it?
Yeah, who got George Galloway out of Bradford, so for that she is to be forever treasured. He's standing in Manchester Gorton, by the way, inevitably. He is, someone once described him as the littlest hobo of of politics. Maybe tomorrow he'll want to settle down, but for this moment he'll just keep moving on. So Naz made some comments before she was elected as an MP on Facebook, topically about Israel, and you know, negative comments that could have been construed as anti-Semitic, and she apologised for them, worked closely with her local synagogue, who all sort of praised how hard she worked, and eventually it all blew over, and you know, her local Jewish community were grateful for how much she tried to change and tried to work with them. So actually, I think it goes to show that if you're willing to swallow it, if you're willing to realise, like you say, your own shortcomings, that you've kind of messed up, you know, obviously it's nice to be nice, so really one should always be aware of one's own failings, I think, from a moral sort of point of view, and try to move on and grow through them. From a cynical point of view, it stops prolonging the life of the story if you just take the heat out of it and go, yeah, shouldn't have done that, messed up, I'll try and be better in the future. All the time you're going, but I don't understand, it's not fair, I didn't do anything wrong at all. You'll then have the press probably trying to dig up more instances in which you have done things wrong, and it will never settle down. I mean, a sports story that we're experiencing at the moment, which is never ever going to end, it would seem, and again has been a bit of a PR nightmare, ironically, really, Team Sky's continuing endeavours, the cycling team, David Brailsford's cycling team, that was set up off the back of the enormous success of British cycling, run by Dave Brailsford. There seems to have been, and we have to be slightly careful, I think, how we talk about this, but there have been some irregularities, shall we say, in some of the ways in which they have been running the medical side of their team, and particularly the dispensing of medications and what sorts of medications they are to people. A Jiffy bag with something in it was taken to Bradley Wiggins. It was delivered personally by the head of British Cycling. Head of women's cycling, and we could go down another path of, and I've been reading Nicole Cook's excellent book recently called Breakaway, and her comments and the comments of many other women around British cycling makes me wonder, well, clearly women aren't important then, if you could send the head of women's cycling across continents to deliver something to a man. But anyway, it was, a package was delivered. It wasn't known what was in the package. They now think it's something which could have been bought over the counter anyway, but the fact of the matter was they hadn't kept any records, and when they were asked why they hadn't kept any records, apparently they just didn't take medical records. And Marina Hyde's written some characteristically excellent articles about this in The Guardian, about how Team Sky were all about control, and you know, they had, you know, painted white floors, and you know, everything's immaculate, and they were, you know, the phrase marginal gains was used all the time, wasn't it? And this idea that, you know, they're obsessive about control. And the thing was, if they had just said at the beginning, we don't know what was in that package, we didn't keep any records, this is appalling, we are having an investigation into it, that would have been fine. But this information had to be dragged out of them through, I mean, they ended up in Parliament, they've been at various select committee hearings and things. And, you know, had Team Sky been, you know, honest about their failings to begin with, now got this complete chaos over, there's been a various complaints made against Shane Sutton, who I think has since stepped down, who was one of the heads of the directors of cycling there. He was first seen appearing in a documentary about Victoria Pendleton in the lead up to the 2012 Olympics, which he did not come out of particularly well, it has to be said. He did not come well out of her book.
No.
Jess Varnish, one of the female cyclists, made a complaint against him about various sexist comments he'd made. They had a hearing. He was got off on all but one charge, but it would now seem that there have been various reports saying that there were recommendations made to the committee which they rejected. It would seem like at every single stage, Team Sky are characterised by the fact that they won't take direction, they won't take advice, and they won't admit that they've got it wrong. But I think they arrogantly assume, like Mr. David Moyes, you know, why are you even questioning me? That was the thing. I was very surprised at people's comments about me. It means, well, why would you dare even to question me in the first place when I'm not wrong? And the fact of the matter is, people like select committees, they don't take no for an answer.
And
nor should they, frankly. And we can't complain about, you know, oh, lazy politicians if then when they do try to you know, scrutinize processes, because Team Sky have always been obsessive about the fact that they are clean. They say, oh, we don't use drugs. And cycling has been a sport which I love, which has been utterly ruined by, you know, by drug revelations. The Tour de France has just been, which was, I grew up loving watching. It's just been a wreck now, really. And I think, you know, Brexit might be a case in point as well. We are living through a phase where, you know, people won't, there's been this hoo-ha over the select committee where, you know, Hilary Benn led the select committee that said, you know, we think we might have problems with Brexit. And the Tory MPs on that committee went, well, no, we don't accept this. What? And I think we're living through an age where people, if they have made up their mind about something, or they are convinced they are right about something, more pertinently, we don't seem to be living, I mean, post-truth era is such a cliche now, isn't it? But we seem to be living in a post-analysis era as well, where we don't analyse things, we make a decision, and then we won't accept anyone questioning it. And it just makes things worse in the long run rather than better, because if people continue to question you, you haven't got a way out, have you?
Absolutely. I mean, in football, the master of the non-apology, of course, is Jose Mourinho. And how life might have been different for Dr. Eva Carneiro if Mourinho knew how to apologise. This week...
And for Mourinho as well, because it was the beginning of the end for him at Chelsea, wasn't it?
It really was. I think it was, you know, it was the snowball that grew into an avalanche, that confrontation on the touchline in that first game. Of the season after you know winning the title, it was the beginning, as you say, of the end. This week, Mourinho didn't make dreadful comments to a woman, but he did try his
something, isn't it? Bless him.
He tried his very best to humiliate Conor McNamara of the BBC by using his old passive aggressive trick, mainly aggressive, of belittling or confronting a reporter to deflect from the vapidity of his team's performance. And there's something really unlikable and disturbing.
Oh, it's horrible. I can't stand Mourinho anymore. And I used to quite like him when he first started out.
Exactly the same with me. You know, when he first came to Chelsea, it was fantastic. We just thought, you know, this was...
But he was so charismatic, I think. And he was really fun and really sort of twinkly and good-humoured. And now you can just, you know, him sitting in the Manchester hotel room with only the trouser press for company.
I've identified where the whole thing turned for me, began to turn with Mourinho, when I noticed his need to undermine and establish his power over people.
Yes.
It was about 10 years ago when Andrei Shevchenko came to Chelsea with an incredible scoring record.
He was the hottest thing on the planet at that point, wasn't
absolutely.
He?
Absolutely. Great record at Milan behind him. And he did find it hard to find his feet at Chelsea. Actually, literally, at times, found it hard to find his
feet. Unfortunately, yeah.
But I always remember his confidence being so deflated and scarred that every time he blazed over the goal from 8 yards out, he took to a habit, a kind of reaction thing, of immediately looking over to the Chelsea bench, where inevitably Mourinho would be beating the floor or smirking,
making
smirky comments to Rui Faria, that sort of thing. And that's driving Shevchenko's confidence even lower under the pitch at Stamford Bridge. Now, I was reminded of this when I saw Mourinho's treatment of Manchester United's Luke Shaw, who has now also adopted the same habit of glancing over at Mourinho each time he nervously kind of belts the ball into the stands instead of reaching Jesse Lingard like 10 yards away or whatever. And instead of seeking to apologise to Luke Shaw for undermining him to every reporter he can find, Mourinho squashes the last remaining dregs of confidence out of the young fellow. So I think,
and let's face it, Luke Shaw came back from a very serious leg break.
Yeah, very much so.
Which is what I object to as well. The fact of the matter is that Luke Shaw has had an extremely traumatic
potentially career ending. Some people say that when Mourinho was at Chelsea a couple of years ago, he did try to sign Luke Shaw from Southampton for Chelsea, and it was a bit bizarre why Shaw didn't join Chelsea, because he lives in that little enclave near the Cobham training ground, so he was the doorstep anyway. But it seems Mourinho has subsequently kind of said off the record that he didn't like Luke Shaw, he didn't like his kind of attitude and the fact that he was very keen on discussing money all the time, and eventually Shaw signed for Manchester United, only, of course, lo and behold, 18 months later, for Mourinho to rock up there as their new manager. So there's sort of history between them. But an apology only has value if it's sincere, of course. Tiger Woods, Bill Clinton, Mel Gibson, famous apologists, only know if their apologies come from the heart. But at least they did say sorry. But I just think Mourinho, Moyes, Brexit, Trump.
It's all coming from the same place as well. And also, we've been living through the era of the non-apology as well, haven't we? Which is the "I'm sorry if you were offended" apology.
Yes, that's it. That's exactly it. Yes, instead of saying I recognise that I've done something really appalling and I do apologise for it, and
is the Naz Shah approach.
Exactly.
Isn't it?
That vapid, empty response of saying, if you were in any way disturbed by my comments, then I apologise, which is kind of twisting it back to making...
It's your fault.
It's blaming the victim,
fault,
isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And interestingly, although we say that sport is... And it'd be interesting to see what the long-term effects are on David Moyes here, because, interestingly, although we complain that sport is occasionally a sexist place, I have to say that I am increasingly cheered by if I have Final Score on in the afternoon on Saturday afternoon, which is the BBC's football results show that goes on for about half an hour to 45 minutes. I don't know if you've seen it, but
Jason Mohammed, isn't it?
They go around and they have two footballers in the studio. Sometimes they're people like Dion Dublin or Danny Mills. They seem to get people that are quite good, and they go round the grounds. Crucially, so
by the way, it's on all afternoon on the red button. It's just on your BBC One for about half an hour.
Okay.
Yeah.
For those of us that won't embrace change, it's on BBC One for half an hour. But for snazzy souls like Terence, it's on the red button. And the thing that makes it so interesting is, and it just goes to show the enormity of the BBC's budget, that they seem to have a reporter at pretty much every ground wherever there's a football game going on. And given that there are four divisions, four sort of top divisions, that's quite an undertaking. But I was very encouraged by the fact that there are as many female voices as there are male voices now.
Oh, good.
So they have people like, not just Jackie Oatley, but I noticed they're using Sue Smith a lot now, the former England international, who I've always really liked, actually. She's a great choice. But so interestingly, I wonder if, when we move on from the Moyes thing, there are more women reporters about now. There is, I think, increasingly a more enlightened attitude. Perhaps not necessarily at the top, unfortunately, but certainly amongst the media, I think there's a more of an enlightened attitude. And it will be interesting to see if in the past, I think in the pre-Richard Keys, Andy Gray era, there would have been a lot of backslapping. But it was interesting that the reaction to that and their downfall from Sky, I think attitudes are changing. And I hope, in a way, that the press continue to give David Moyes a hard time off the back of this, really. Mm. And that rather than, you know, moving on from this incident, I hope that they do not grant him any favours when interviewing him in the future. And I hope that they use this to colour their opinion of him, because it certainly has coloured my opinion of him. I was always something of a defender of poor old unlucky Alf, but I thought it was such a vile yeah, way so to behave that, you know, I really hope that his life is made difficult by the press. And I don't often side with the press, but I very much do in this instance.
Now, it's about this sort of time that listeners begin to get a bit restless, anxious to know of your public appearances this coming week.
Yes, indeed. Well, and this we seem to be going through a phase where I don't have very many. Although the next couple of Fridays I have things that are on, so I'm not sure where we will be for recording. But I think I'm doing something next Friday evening, Good Friday evening. I think I'm doing my monthly Rip It Up DJ night at the Palace, which is 9 until 12, I think, nowadays. That keeps changing, so that's on Hastings Seafront. I'm doing the Saturday Social this evening. Hooray! Yay! So that's my radio thing. 1967 this week, so we'll be doing an hour of 1967 from 6 to 7 p.m. on barricaderadio.com. I'm also doing Indie Wonderland next Wednesday, 8 to 10 p.m. barricaderadio.com. Tunes and chat, and also continuing to play my new track of the month.
Excellent. Now, I also understand that at one of your speaking ventures recently, you told a story involving my former Sunday football teammate, broadcaster extraordinaire, Tommy Boyd.
Indeed, yes. And of course, you know everyone, so I always forget that you do. So I spoke last week about doing this talk. I've started sort of accidentally with this semi-career doing this talking about talking thing. I'd started off doing it at Petra Kucha, and then I got asked to do this thing last week. I might now be going over to Brighton to do it as well in the summer, it would seem. So that's a lot of fun. And I was based around lots of things. I'm very taken with a book called Radiohead by John Osborne. Not that John Osborne. About him listening to 30 Days of Radio. He was a contemporary of mine at university. And he listened. He got a job. I didn't know him really at university, but we were both in the Creative Writing Society. He stayed on in Norwich and ended up doing a temp job for, I think, somebody like Anglia Windows, and it was just data entry. And he tells this book is his story of this kind of not brilliant time in his life, but he decides to listen to 30 radio stations in 30 days, different ones, on his headphones at work. And he talks about how much he loves radio and how he's grown up with it. And he tells the story that Tommy Boyd, someone rang into Tommy Boyd's Talk Sports show once, a woman rang in and heard this. And I've since heard the footage, and I really, really hope it's true and it's not just an urban myth. So this will be my last major contribution this week. But so Tommy Boyd's lady rang in and told him the story of the time that she decided she was going to get a train to work, and she thought to make it cheerier, she treat herself to a Kit Kat from the train stations. It's a four-fingered Kit Kat. So she got onto the... Yeah, who wouldn't want one? I don't eat Nestle products, but I need to get over this. So she got on the train and read a few pages of her book and then decided it was time to open the Kit Kat. So she opened the Kit Kat. She had the first finger of the Kit Kat, and then she put it on the table in front of her. And sat opposite her was a rather angry-looking skinheaded chap. And I know that you know, skinheads in repose are often inclined to look quite cross. And he was described as a skinhead. So it wasn't just a chap that was bald. It was someone that was dressed in a manner that skinheads would do and was a sort of actively a member of the skinhead
community. Bit intimidating.
Yes, and not least because he did genuinely look quite specifically cross.
Okay.
He then picked up the Kit Kat from the table and ate the second finger cross manner. Not great. And so this lady is, you know, as you can imagine, rather outraged by this. So instantly eats the third finger of her Kit Kat. And in a slightly cross manner, if one can eat in a cross manner. At which point the skinhead, his riposte to this is to pick up the remaining finger of the Kit Kat and eat it in one bite.
My God.
I know, indeed. So the lady gets off the train absolutely steamingly angry at the loss of half of her Kit Kat by a very angry chap. Being British, they did not discuss this. They just sat there in angry silence for the rest of the day, rest of the journey. So she goes into work, has a good old rant to her colleague about how cross she is about it, sits down, opens her handbag to get her purse out, and finds an unopened four-finger Kit Kat.
Oh, my God.
the story for the ages, isn't it, really? And I told this story to this room of people who, I mean, it was a struggle to regain control. And I said, look, it's not my story. It was told in John's book from Tommy Boyd's show. But it just goes to show, I think, the magic of radio, that it is just basically storytelling. And if you get the right stories, it is fab. So yeah. The Kit Kat story is now one that I can literally dine out on, I should think.
Excellent. Juliet went to see the Jesus and Mary train on Thursday night. We'll find out if they were any good. All after a track from this new album, Damage and Joy. It's the Jesus and Mary train. Featuring the splendid Isabel Campbell on guest vocals. That's the Jesus.
Ooh, I know. Always a pleasure to hear her.
Very much so, yeah. For the Jesus and Mary Chain from their stirring new album, Damage and Joy. And that was track 5 of 14, Songs for a Secret. And, yeah, this new album is a strong collection, excellently produced by Youth, by the way. Mm. And we were talking about the rise of women, 4 different women on guest vocals throughout the album, which I think really helps create a kind of changing identity between the tracks, and including on 2 tracks, the Reed Brothers' younger sister, Linda, which I think is really, rather sweet. Jules, how much of the new album featured when you went to see Jesus and Mary Chain at the Delawarr Pavilion?
Yes, indeed. Well, a lot of it did, actually. So my bugbear is people that go to see bands that they know are touring an album. All the publicity is touring an album. I mean, in this case, so we turned up and there was a merchandise. I'll tell you about the merchandise all in a minute because it was very entertaining. But much of the merchandise was based on Damage and Joy, and the cover to Damage and Joy, if you haven't seen it, is people couldn't work out what it was, but it appears to me to be a bowl of tomato soup in a kind of a porcelain bowl with or some sort of red soup, and it has Damage and Joy spelt out in what appear to be those spaghetti alphabet letters you can buy. I think that's what it is.
I didn't figure that out. I've been looking at it and couldn't figure it out. Okay.
Well, that's my theory anyway. It's what it looks like. As someone that was a very big alphabet spaghetti fan, both as a child and then as an ironic student, I have some form in this area. But anyway, so he's turned up. So much of the merchandise store was selling this kind of branded stuff. The backdrop to the stage set was a huge recreation of the Damage and Joy cover. They really could not have been more open about the fact that they were doing Damage and Joy, and I can't stand people that go to see band tour a new album and then complain that they didn't do any hits, because they are touring a new album, guys. This is how you make money from music nowadays. You go on tour. They did do a lot on the new album, which was excellent, and I would say about the Jesus and Mary Chain, I mean, my dad, who often makes cameo appearances on this podcast, as he would say about them, I like their song. I mean, you know, they don't have a hugely varied output, it has to be said, and the new stuff sounded much like the old stuff, but that was not a bad thing, because I like how they sound. Having said that, they did a lot of hits as well. I was really surprised. They were really good. They did my favourite from the new album, Amputation, first, which I was pleased and disappointed about, because then they'd kind of done it early on, but they really built up a kind of a momentum as they went along, and towards the end of their first set, they did Some Candy Talking, Halfway to Crazy, and Reverence as their three songs, the kind of which we thought was fantastic. They went off and then they came back, and their encore included Just Like Honey and You Trip Me Up. So actually, they did do quite a lot of their kind of signature tunes. I was not old enough to remember them the first time round, when they used to play for 10 minutes. And then spark riots at various places. The crowd used to riot because they only played for 10 minutes. They are somewhat more aged now, shall we say. And they did look at the lead singer was a very sort of well turned out chap, but everybody else did look a bit like a scarecrow, I'm afraid to say. My friend said they played a full set and they were nice. The lead singer was, they're never a chatty band, they never expect to be full of the joys of the stream, but the lead singer thanked everybody for coming and told someone off for complaining when they said they were going to do something off the new album and told them to get over it, which I was a very big fan of, and was genuinely seemed quite pleasant. And I have to say, it was a really enjoyable evening. It didn't, we talked previously about the Laura and Voodoo gig I went to see there and how badly it sold. They had shut the terraces again, which I thought was the show that it didn't sell that much. Having said that, though, I would say it was at least 2/3 full, and the venue is 1,500, so probably a bit more than that, I would say. But then my bugbear on this is the tickets were £27.50.
Ooh, gosh, that's quite a lot for...
Which is dear, but really. I mean, considering it was on a Thursday night as well, and I'm sorry, but they are pitching to the kind of aged audience now to whom that is an issue, I'm sorry to say. But so maybe that had some impact on it. But I'm really glad I went. They were great to see. The merchandise store, by the way, again, a reflection of perhaps their somewhat older audience nowadays. I bought a Damage and Joy mug to drink out of my tea out of at my desk, and my friend Susan bought a Psycho Tandy candy tea towel. They were set lots of tea towels, and they were quite popular, I think. She said, I am horrified by this, yet I cannot resist buying one. So obviously at some point we hope to dry up the Damage and Joy mug with the Psycho Candy tea towel. That's ultimately the aim. But yeah, they played really well, I thought, and they had a real energy about them, and also it was really fun to see a lot of quite drunk super fan men dancing around and having a lovely time. So yes, they are perhaps nostalgia acts, but I thought that the new music was as good as the old stuff.
Now you've explained about the cover, I feel a complete buffoon, because I've just looked at it again,
and
it's absolutely obviously what you said, and I feel a fool. I've been looking at it for about a week, and I didn't pick up what the cover was. It is indeed exactly.
And I think it was a cake, if it makes you feel any better.
There we are.
That wasn't meant to be. I'm sorry to have made you feel bad. Wasn't the aim.
No. In their first years in the 1980s, before you were even with us,
or at least consciously with us. Anyway.
Yes, exactly. I found the gap between their live performances and their records to be really interesting, in that live, as you mentioned, they established a reputation for kind of chaotic, noisy, uncoordinated gigs. As you said, often used to collapse and fall apart after 20 minutes or something. And yet their records have always had an edge of sophistication.
Absolutely, yeah.
Influences, I guess they borrowed Phil Spector in terms of production and sound. Yes. And I don't think it's exaggerating to say elements of the Beach Boys and the melodies and the songwriting.
And the Beatles as well, I think they're very much influenced by the Beatles. They are they've got a very 60s sensibility matched to a kind of a rock sensibility. I feel like they're sort of a later generation Velvet Underground.
Yes, I think it's hard to figure another group or artist where there's such a... was it paradox or a dichotomy between live appearances and the sound on the records? But what's interesting, I think, is that like so many bands that have split and subsequently reunited, the Reed Brothers seem to have found that individually they can't make the same impact as when they're together.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And they did have a woman sing with them on stage, by the way, for a couple of songs. So I wondered if that might have been Linda Reed. It certainly wasn't Isabel Campbell. I would have known if it was.
Right. So it very possibly was Linda, yes. So, yeah, Jesus Mary Chain, excellent, it seems, live then, currently on tour. And, I think we both really... I think the new album, Damage and Joy, is really, really good. I played it two or three times this week and thoroughly enjoyed it.
It's a really good record. I can also recommend, by the way, speaking of the Jesus and Mary Chain's somewhat grumpy reputation that they have... Which they were very pleasant on stage, but I'm a big fan of Beatles covers, and Mojo magazine did a whole series a couple of years ago where they featured all of the different Beatles albums, and they did cover mount CDs of covers of Beatles songs. And Jim Reed did a spectacularly grumpy version of And Your Bird Can Sing that was an acoustic version that was the complete opposite of what the actual sort of song is, which is a very cheery kind of uplifting burst. I would recommend checking it out because it is really good, but it is very funny the extent to which he is kind of grumpily in a Scottish accent, kind of in a low voice, talking about And Your Bird Can Sing at half the pace. Is extremely enjoyable.
Excellent. It's fair to say we have a super group to play us out this week, Jules.
We do, and actually, interestingly, we can go back to where we started from, in that we were talking about this Radio 1 Established covers, and the last song on it is Corinne Bailey Rae, who I've also seen at the Delawar, strangely enough, doing Steady As She Goes by the Raconteurs. The Raconteurs were Jack White from the White Stripes' first go at a supergroup, and that they had some people from the Greenhorns in them. He then took some of the Raconteurs with him to do his next supergroup, which was this band, the Deb Weather. The lead singer is Alison Mosshart, who's also known as Vivi. She sang and I think still does sing in The Kills with Jamie Hintz, formerly of Scarfo. So supergroups and reconstituted groups seem to be the order of the day, don't they? And this comes from an album called Whorehound, spelled Horehound, and I think this is a great album. It's got a brilliant song on it called Celebrate Your Mother, which was or Treat Me Like Your Mother, sorry, which became quite a famous sort of single for them. But I really like this as well, and I just think it's a really sort of nice sounding rock album, and this is Bonehouse.
I build a house, I build a home. You have been listening to a DACM Media production.